So welcome. My name is Paul. It's a privilege to be here with you. I had the occasion through one of our church benefits association, kind of a denominational gathering of different people, to come across Russ, and we got talking about educational funding models, and he invited us to come and share some thoughts. So it's wonderful to be here with you. I saw a friend of mine at church on Sunday, who happens to be a professor and in leadership at our small college, North Park. And I mentioned to him that I was going to be down here with you. And his response was, you know, if you're pulling together a PowerPoint on reimagining funding, you know, maybe you could share it with me as a faculty voice before I go. And I love faculty. I am faculty. I've served as an adjunct before. But my reaction to that walking away was no, because everything that I've heard through a trustee's perspective comes through the lens of educational trends. And I think it's useful for us to have more time. In fact, maybe a question for you. All of you come from different spheres of influence and expertise, far more than anything that I would offer. When was the last time that you got to a Board of Trustees meeting and they said, you know what, we're going to take the morning and we're just going to hear from you. We're going to present our model and we want to hear from you, white space thinking, about the structure of our model and the way that we finance ourselves. Unless your experience is really different than mine, we never give ourselves time to reimagine, because there's always something to take care of this month or next quarter. So you can see this confident title. We're supposed to solve educational funding in the next hour and 15 minutes. But I put reimagine because I hope this is, I have 15 slides, of which two are the beginning and the end. So I hope this is a little bit of space for us to think together, to poke a little bit, to think together about some different ways of looking at education by studying non-education spaces and what that might mean. And I'll end up with a little example of a pilot that we've started to reimagine education funding in a different way. I also have a question mark because it's not just about funding. We tend to use endowments as a proxy for how well we're doing. But we all know in the corporate sense or in any other industry, if you're well-funded with a business model that's not sustainable, it's not good stewardship. And so if we're thinking about reimagining funding, that's great. We also need to be thinking about innovating in the way that we do the work and ultimately that we serve who we're serving. So I will warn you, my lens is probably like all of you. I am not an academic. I'm an alumnus. I played sports in college. I was a trustee. I've been an employer. I've filled out FAFSAs. I now work as the CFO of our denomination, so I serve a bit as kind of the parent owner voice, so I see it through that lens. I'm a co-signer, and I'm a huge advocate for small colleges. I'm a product of one. I've been an investment banker in my past, but a lot of people were praying for me, so I found a way out. I've been an adjunct faculty member, and I'm definitely a concerned citizen when it comes to small colleges. And the one thing that I would say, I have two kids in college, two yet to go. I have a daughter who's at Seattle Pacific University out in Seattle, and I have a son who's at Case Western University in Ohio. And going through the process with them, Christian, non-Christian, selective, non-selective, small, large, in the middle, urban, rural, what was astounding to me was at the most selective institutions, if they were privileged to get in, there is no merit scholarship. At least maybe for two or three kids who end up going to Vanderbilt or wherever. But there is 100% financial need scholarship, and it is funded by very large endowments. And then we would go to small schools, and I would see the amount of aid thrown their way, and I would realize that most of that aid was unfunded by very small endowments. And so this is not news to you, but it was a very kind of real-time example of some of the issues that we're facing. So, I'm curious, as we begin, just kind of popcorn, throw out some of the industries that you come from. Where does your expertise lie? Okay, great. Where else? Trust and estate. Awesome. Healthcare. Excellent. 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 Thank you. So how many of you have feel as though you brought the gifts that you've developed in those industries to use in your role as a trustee of your institution? Fully. Good. That's good. I always felt a gap. I always felt that there was more that we could leverage of these incredible resources we call trustees if only we gave them space and time to bring their gifts into the setting. And I think that's going to be required for educational institutions. So let's start with talking about stewardship. In 2008, I was the chair of our pension board, which cares for the defined benefit plan of our pastorate in the Evangelical Covenant Church. And it was 2008, and the market was roiling. And I was preparing for a board meeting, and the portfolio was down 25%, and I didn't know what to do. And so I read this quote, which is a derivative of a quote that no one can figure out who actually said at the start, but in periods of great market dislocation, don't just do something, stand there. And it was actually the most sage thing that we could have done. And so don't do anything rash, right? We know that in an investment context or in an endowment context, right? Don't fear the market. Don't sell when the market is buying. Don't buy when the market is selling. And so that's still very wise counsel when it comes to the truth about managing money in our endowments. I think the fear, or one of the questions, is whether that idea has permeated our approach to when things are roiling around us in the business model of education. And I would argue that the exact opposite is true. That while we have to care for the endowment by not being rash, certainly we don't want to be rash in the operating model, but we have to do something. Stewardship with a large endowment and a suboptimal economic or structural model of delivering our services ultimately isn't sustainable, and it's not good stewardship. So we can't be rash. But how often do we read? You know, I open Pension and Investments magazine, and I see the top 20 educational endowments, as though somehow that's a proxy for stewardship of those that we care for. And I would just argue that that isn't ultimately stewardship. So what is stewardship? I don't know, but I've thought about it through my context that it seems that funding is a part of it. It's sustainable funding, to be sure, but ultimately of effective delivery structures that create value for those that we serve. And so if you flip that in the other model, it would seem that stewardship is not sustainable funding of delivery systems that create long-term distress for those who we serve. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the trends that collectively we face. But all that to say, as we talk about funding, funding is really important. But funding in a vacuum without also evaluating how to restructure what we do in ways that are not rash, in ways that can't be totally transformed, is missing an opportunity to steward well for those that we care for. So more funding without structural innovation and value creation really is a delay tactic. I will say personally, having been on the tours and having tried to do a lot of research and talking to a lot of friends and colleagues on different boards, I am 100% convinced that the next 10 years is going to see a whole lot of small college closures, mergers, consolidation, partnerships. And so we have decisions to make about coupling innovation in funding with the way that we deliver business. That's a daunting element of the work that we get to do. I actually find that energizing. But we have to have enough space together as boards to evaluate how to move education forward into the future. So we don't have to look very far for the problems. They come to us. They're pretty well defined. And I found this quote that we need to better design structures that reflect the fact that universities operate in the real world. And there's always this tension between the real world and academia and its relevance and its business model. And I just want to say I think there are some things that we can learn from looking at models that are outside of education. How often do we get together and we study the Nakubo tables and we look at what other people are doing in terms of program delivery? Anyone read Blue Ocean in the past, right? The idea that everyone is always hovering around the blood and the water, but 99.9% of the ocean is free and open. And how do we spend more time whiteboarding and thinking about how we might deliver our services in more compelling ways, not for us, but for those that we serve. The pace of external threats is going up. We've been living in an economy over the last 11 years that's been really good. Unemployment's been low. Interest rates have been near zero. Market returns and the endowment hopefully have been pretty strong. So what happens? We're not really in a storm of a market context. We're more fearful about it, but we're in a storm about the demographic trends and the trends in education. What happens in other sectors who try to wait out the storm, even if they have a good reserve or endowment? What can we learn from other sectors? So it's already been mentioned, but name some sectors that have been transformed in the last 10 years or so. Retail. Everywhere you go. Every strip mall, every major mall, right? Closing, shuttering. I read today that Eddie Lampert is going to try to reinstate Sears once again. Who in this room believes that that's going to work well? You know, that's a very, very difficult model. What? Banking, investment, right? The rise of online brokers and Charles Schwab and entirely new banking mechanisms for an entirely new generation.
Communication with BlackBerry.
Yeah. Yeah.
The iPhones,
maybe dropping off some. Yeah. I was just talking with my son about the fax machine I had not too long ago that had a single spool. Remember that? You'd have like 20-foot sheet of paper coming out. You'd have to cut into pieces. What else? Taxis, Uber. Good. So these are very different industries, very different dynamics. But I think it's instructive to look at them through the eyes of funding models, but also structural changes, right? Through the eyes of, does funding itself solve the solution? So let's look at it. Russ, that was an excellent, excellent transition. This is the cost of a New York City medallion to be able to operate a taxi until 2014. So up to $1 million. Look at the growth since 2004, a five-fold growth in the cost of having a license in New York City to operate taxis. Now, I don't know specifically, maybe you do, if what the correlation is of how many you can operate under this umbrella, but it's not much. It's a handful at best. And if I took away the Uber sign, you can imagine what's happened to this since, right? And so think of the investment that taxi drivers made in New York City for the privilege of serving you. And you can begin to understand the ire that they have for the way that so many of us transport today. Now, the economy was doing wonderfully. Disposable income was rising. The stock market was going up. Interest rates were low. People were using cabs. But no one was attentive to how the industry was changing to create value. Now, this didn't actually happen, but what if someone in New York City came to them at the peak of the cycle and they said, it's getting really expensive to own a medallion, but I have a new funding mechanism. I have a new 0% loan that's going to allow you to absorb that cost in a much greater way. Absolutely nothing would have changed about the trend in that industry, right? It would have been a delay tactic. It would have been better for the cab driver, no pass-through value creation for the consumer. Nothing about the reduction in fixed costs or the ability to have a cab and, or an Uber in 5 minutes. So simple reinforcement that as we think about unique funding models, which Uber has created, it is not a funding model alone. It is value creation for those that they desire to serve. And so those that we desire to serve in Christian higher education need to be at the front of our mind. Retail. Someone mentioned retail. So Sears we've talked a little bit about, but let me change that tune. By the way, Sears, big box, not a huge online presence, some wonderful brands, all of which they've sold off at this point, Craftsman, Land's End. But this happened, the Sears liquidation has happened in the midst of a rising economy, low unemployment, everything that you would have expected, right? To culminate in really good performance, but they are exogenous factors, right, that are driving the change in the industry. So who in the big box, not online, who in the big box retail space has thrived in this environment? Best Buy. In places. They've cut a lot of stores as well, but have found a path through. Who else? Home Depot. Yeah, in my town, we have a Home Depot, Menards, and a Lowe's within about two blocks of each other. Who else? Outlet malls, niche, more outlet malls. Yep, the big malls are suffering. Kohl's. Yeah, that's actually an interesting one. Target. Yeah, Target. Seems like every... between Amazon and Target, that is my credit card bill, it seems. Think about Costco, too. Who shops at Costco or Sam's Club? Anyone know the real financing model of Costco or Sam's Club at a high level? How they actually make their money? Membership is part of it, so they have a sticky kind of subscriber base. How else? What is the value that Costco offers to you? Scale, size, what else? Price, right? Too much of probably what you don't need at a really cheap price, right? And then you're walking through some aisle 5B and you find some other piece of joy that you didn't even know you needed, but now you need it, right? But here's what they're actually doing. So there's clear value to you. You go there, you can get a pair of socks and 20 gallons of milk and 100 burgers, right, for your church barbecue. It's the largest wine cellar in the country, maybe in the world. So there's clear value to you, but here's their financing model, which is really interesting. They're a bank. So what they do is they buy in huge bulk from their vendors, and they buy in such bulk that they push out their vendor terms, and they don't have to pay them for a while. So they're borrowing stuff from their vendors. How do they turn that stuff into cash? They sell it to you quickly. And not only did they sell it to you quickly, how do you pay when you go there? Cash, debit card, maybe MasterCard, no more Amex. So they're only allowing payment mechanisms that allow them to convert into cash really quickly. And then they have 90 days or whatever to pay their vendors. They're a bank. They invest those proceeds over 90 days. So the quicker they turn it around, the more they can invest. Now, that's a simplification of the model. The detail I wouldn't understand. But in essence, they've created a funding model that also is inextricably tied to the value that it creates for you, right? And so again, just an example, totally different industry, totally different price point. But as we talk about funding, let's also make sure we're talking about the model and the way that we deliver. By the way, none of this is easy. None of what I'm going to tell you, half of which you'll say it's not even feasible or possible. But again, I think it's our obligation as trustees to think outside for the incredible array of skills that you in this room bring to these boards about new ways and new mechanisms of delivery. So bear with me. There are a couple of finance constructs that I have found helpful in thinking about the educational structure. The first is for any of the finance types in the room, just kind of corporate dividend theory. If you have a private company or a public company, there are basically two things you can do with your earnings. You can pay them out to your investors in the form of a dividend, or you can keep them and plow them back into the business to grow the business like Google or transform the business into something that it needs to be transformed into, right? So Google doesn't pay a huge dividend because they have plenty of growth opportunities. They would rather invest in higher returning growth opportunities to transform their model than give the cash to you. They believe they can earn a higher return. We don't really have excess earnings, at least not where I spend time in the education space. It's always obviously a struggle. But these are the two things we can fundamentally do with our resources. So let's call it our endowment. We do have investors. We've got people, faithful kids coming in and paying huge amounts of money, whether funded by them or a government program or Pell. And I would argue that our endowments are largely being used as a dividend, which means rather, and I'm not minimizing the restrictions on our endowments, but generally rather than using what we can or campaigns to reimagine and restructure what we do, we would rather hand you the money. We think the return is better to hand you what we can, funded in some cases, unfunded in others, even worse, and then you, through a series of Pell Grants and federal loan programs, go figure it out. But hopefully you can finish on time and get an average starting salary that serves you well. So basically what we're saying is, with an endowment that is kind of often used as a last resort or as a grand protector of education, we're going to give you what we can. Because the assumption is that by reinvesting it in our own model, we can't access a greater level of return to create value for you. And so to some extent, we're leaving people on their own. So the endowment is often seen as a buffer, as a show of strength, as a show of stewardship, as a grand protector, as a last resort of funding. Annual budget draws are increasing 4%, 5%, 6%. Now what's going to happen with the markets? All of us are having these kinds of conversations about our operating budget reliance on the endowment. So the irony in that is that waiting out the storm is likely not to be. These trends are going to persist. And so waiting out the storm alone or growing the endowment alone is not going to be a viable long-term strategy. As you know, the largest endowments in the country are disproportionately getting larger than the small endowments. And that has to do with not so much investment expertise, just scale and scale of donor base in a changing nature of philanthropy. So growing the endowment is not enough. So here's an idea, and where we'll end today is around something on a very small scale that we're starting to think about in this area. What if instead of a campaign or instead of the endowment as a buffer, as a last resort, as a grand protector, what if we activated it? What if we flipped that model? And restrictions aside, what if we found a way to activate that to transform elements of our operating model, which would strengthen current operations so that you have less of a need for that endowment? Does that make sense? Just the flip of viewing the endowment, which is how a corporation views their retained earnings or their reserves, is we can either pay them out and bleed this model forward, or we can transform what we're doing. So what would that look like? Just an idea that's been in our minds. The second model is fixed and variable costs. So fixed costs are costs which don't change as volume or enrollment changes. Variable costs are costs that do. So it seemed in the first session, the easier way to talk about this is, what are truly variable costs in higher education that change as enrollment changes? What costs change with enrollment? Pretty clearly. What's that? Okay? The board? Room and board. Food. Yeah, food. Food and beverage. Absolutely. What else? Faculty? What kind of faculty is variable? Yep, exactly. So why do we do it? Obviously, it's cheap. It's variable. You're an at-will employee. Absolutely. Now, beyond those two categories, there's not much. And the reality is you can look at, and I'm not here to dispel tenure. There are wonderful things about tenure. And it may be that you have a service line where someone retires or leaves, and so you choose not to fill a tenured position, or you close a department, and so it's maybe step variable, but it's fixed. And I can tell you from doing some phone calls and some research with friends, it's not uncommon that our fixed costs would be 80% or more variable. Obviously, huge amount of staffing, huge amount of fully loaded costs, and even utilities and other things that sometimes would be variable are really quite fixed. You have productive facilities. So fixed costs are not a bad thing. Unless you have the wrong business model for fixed costs. So let's just talk a little bit in more detail. If you look at a unit, which for us would be a student, you have a price that you charge per student, and you have variable costs per student, not fixed costs, variable costs, which gives you what you make on a student after you deploy the labor and the stuff you need to serve that student. And we've already agreed, there's not a lot of variable costs. But unfortunately for us, there's probably not a lot of margin either because the pricing pressure is also very significant, right? So if you know what you make per student and you know what your fixed costs are, how many millions and millions of dollars, if you divide what you make per student by that, you get your break even, right? How many students do we need? And very few institutions would do the cost accounting to go down and allocate every cost to a student. But we all have a pretty good sense from our leadership, here's kind of where we need to be, right? And if it falls below this level, you should be concerned, because we're highly, highly fixed cost models, which means we're highly enrollment dependent. Unless you have an outsized endowment, which I'm guessing none of us do, we are exceptionally enrollment dependent. Why does this matter? Because as demographics around the way that students are desiring to go through school, extended duration, all of these things, it's very hard for us to bridge that trend because we need people in chairs constantly to cover our fixed costs. Seems to me that where we are in Orlando is the bastion of fixed cost models. So Disney, Hollywood, Universal, think of the fixed cost investment that they make, which is a wonderful model if your unit profit is high. I was at Disney 2 weeks ago. I can assure you their unit profit is high. And if you have higher accelerating volume, even on lower profitability, it seems to me that we don't have either in our current context. We might have it in a program or two. I don't see a lot of fast pass lines at small colleges, right? I see wait lists at hyper-selective colleges, but all of us are having enrollment pressure and margin erosion. So it's not that a fixed cost model is bad. It's simply that we have a disconnect between where fixed cost models work well. Think about our lens when we have a down year. If you have a down year where enrollment is down 15%, what I often hear or I read about is we have to get through this for 4 years, right? Because it cycles through over that period of time. One of my friends said it's kind of the rabbit in the snake being digested, right? And that is precisely because of our fixed cost model. The problem with that is that thinking is so internal, right? There's nothing about that where we're professing how sad it is that we didn't get to create the value for those students that should have been in those chairs. It's all about how to retain our strength, and we have to think that way, right? Because we have limited resources, but it just starts to give you a lens for how internal we can be. What is our average campaign for? What do we do a campaign for? Capital, improvements, deferred maintenance, build another building, fixed costs or variable? Fixed. We add to it. Why do we add to it? Because ex-Wesleyan University or non-Wesleyan University has a new gym. We can't recruit players unless we have a new gym. Or they need a science building. We need a science building. Every college everywhere in America trying to replicate every service line. It's impossible. We get caught up in this cycle, and now we have more fixed costs and more deferred maintenance unless someone's been kind enough to endow us to cover all of that. So the cycle continues, and we have to do these things. I'm not minimizing the need for a new gym to recruit players, but we're only adding to a model that has some issues. So the second thing, the takeaway on this is simply that at some level, we have to be relentless about our pursuit to lower the break-even, because the only way to serve students that increasingly are going to take longer, that are leading complex lives, that are needing to work to limit the student debt issue, is to be able to absorb that, which means to have more variable costs that we can toggle. And so we'll talk a little bit about how institutions have responded to that. But I want to talk about healthcare for a minute, and someone mentioned it in the room. We have a local independent hospital in Chicago, credible 400-bed facility. Swedish Covenant Hospital tries to stay above water, fighting all of the big systems, somehow has been able to do that. Really tough slog. But it's interesting to me, if you look at it, there have been some articles written, but why aren't we talking more about the comparison of a different kind of tenured faculty in the healthcare environment? And so if you just think about some of the trends, either because you're in it or you use it, bundled payments are forcing independent physicians to work with institutions. There's no other way to get paid now. Think about that in the context of education. Capitation, pay-for-service is moving to these bundled payments, which forces us to be in alignment, forces hospitals and physicians to work on reducing length of stay, fewer time, fewer amount of days in a bed. And the opportunity cost of a bed might be $500,000 a year. So if you clear up that bed quicker, you can push more volume through a higher fixed cost business. So think of the correlation to looking at programs in education, trying to figure out a way to make them shorter or less fixed cost intensive. Hospitals have penalties if they readmit someone within 30 days. What's the correlation to that in education? What a penalty if you don't finish. Now, someone pointed out these are very different models. Most of the payers are obviously external forces and regulatory forces that are driving this. It's an excellent point. It's absolutely true. We are kind of our own allocator of capital in a lot of ways, although we've relied much more heavily on federal sources. So, again, it drives back to us and what are we going to do in the future. Physician discretion. All of us have friends who are professors who would rather just be left alone. Thank you. We'll set the curriculum. We'll teach what needs to be taught, and they're right. They're awesome at what they do. These are our stewards who build relationships. But interesting in healthcare that if it's one of X number of diagnoses, you have to deploy evidence-based medicine. If you don't give aspirin within 2 minutes for a certain myocardial infarction, whatever it is, there are consequences because evidence suggests that outcomes are better if you do this. And so interesting to look at some of the performance-driven outcomes. Standalone hospitals. Every community hospital, because it's one facility, needs to try to be everything. it needs to try to have oncology in a birthing center. It's very difficult, not only for volume, but for faculty load. And so what's happening in the market is not only consolidation, but centers of excellence, right? Why should it be if you have four facilities that in an educational setting that we all try to have every single discipline imaginable? How might we work together as a Christian education community within the Wesleyan core and without to better leverage capacity in different places so that if you want to do this, you go there or you do it online? I was astounded. I went to Northwestern for grad school, and here's a selective undergrad school who at least at some time in the past said that if you come here, you can take up to a certain percentage of your courses at a cohort of eight other small Ivy schools. So what are they doing? They're distributing the load maybe in places where they don't have the faculty load or where they don't want to build it. And they're even doing that at that level. And they have an endowment that can withstand it. So really interesting to think about how little, I know this in the Church Benefits Association, where how little denominations even within coordinate. So this is such a blessing to for you to be able to talk together, but even between denominations, how do we share in some of these risks and get the benefit of pooling? Any observations on just healthcare in particular? I've just found it to be an interesting comparison, especially because our denomination has tentacles into both areas. What jumps out to you in there? We do it in three basic areas. We have one standalone hospital. We had another standalone hospital in California that we sold a few years ago. We have 12, I think is the number, retirement facilities around the country that provide different levels of acute care. And then we have some enabling residences that serve disabled children and adults in different places around. So those would be the three areas, but only one acute care hospital. Yeah, they are different concepts, but maybe, you know, the first two are kind of constant at any level of setting, large or small, because of the regulatory and the insurance drivers. The third is that if you're increasingly focused on pay for performance and physician-hospital alignment, it's easier and even more effective to do if every hospital is not trying to replicate every service, but you're getting centers of excellence with higher volume, therefore higher, better outcomes over time. So, all true. You know, one question I had, I should know this better, but what is the prevalence of, you know, our small hospital, one of the ways that it survives is we are part of a multi-billion-dollar group purchasing organization, which obviously healthcare expenses are different than education, but anyone aware of just the prevalence of even purchasing synergy across Wesleyan colleges or in a broader sense?
The
It's interesting. I was, our university was building a science center, and our hospital was building a women's medical clinic. And so I had the two together working for the church and talking about a shared contribution to each other's project. And one of the people at the hospital said, you know, you guys over there, they're two blocks away. You know, you built a science building. It would have been great if you could have run your, you probably bought $8 million in medical equipment. It would have been great if you could have run that through our group purchasing organization. And it just occurred to me that it didn't happen, but they weren't talking. And they drove by each other all the time. They know a science building was going up. And so, you know, other forms of capital leverage with affiliated healthcare entities or whatever it might be, are other places to look. But even if the outcomes aren't what you hope for, that's a good outcome. It means you're doing the work as well, which is really important. All right. You know your realities. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these pages, but I want to tell you some of the realities that we saw as we formed what we're working on. Student debt, you know the story. What might surprise you is that since the crisis, auto debt is only up 50%. Versus 157%. Credit and mortgage debt is actually down. That was astounding to me. But having worked for banks before, the Basel standards, the straining of capital, what was also eye-opening to me is the home equity transfer, right? So after 2008, there was a lot of student debt that was on mom and dad's home equity line prior to that. And so you think about the distress at the family level based on student debt that we don't even see, right? Defaults are highest among those who are most vulnerable in our population and certainly in our institution. That's just a huge focus of who we desire to serve. It's also harder to attract the highest quality students from those settings because there's such well-funded endowments at larger institutions. Our collective response has been funded and unfunded, discount increasing. Over that period of time. And alongside that, Pell percentages haven't kept up, and we have an uncomfortable reliance on federal student debt. And the broader question away from the economics of it is, you know, what are the implications of that longer term as Christian as educational institutions in higher ed in terms of that that government alignment? But again, there's kind of a dividend strategy. We'll give you what we can, funded and unfunded, from our endowment, and we'll leave you on your own to go out and try to create value through that. Students are taking longer to get through. There's lower four-year completion rates. I assume that's common for many of us. There is some declining average student quality, increasing complexity of student lives. When I teach, I'm astounded at the number of students that are working full-time, that are trying to get through school, that are married, that are pregnant. It's remarkable what students are trying to do. And an increasing prevalence of commuter and remote population. And one of the struggles that I see, and it may be different if you're in a more rural area, but in an urban context, if you combine an increasing commuter population with an increasing commuter professor population, that can be a difficult environment to create the kind of real community that we're desiring, which holds retention and other things. I think I do an okay job building relationships with students when I teach, but I have a full-time job elsewhere, and I don't have the same time, and so I'm not delivering the services in the same quality. So one thing to look at is, what is your evaluation process for the real effectiveness through the student's eyes of your adjunct professors? I think that's something that we can all do better in and is a pretty easy task. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great point, and it's very. Well, we'll talk a little bit about the program we created and some of the nuances, particularly around attracting lower income students to it. Just a few last points on our reality. Competition is fierce, and it's fierce, so it costs more to acquire students, and it's fierce in the midst of an overall demographic that's not great, right? Especially in certain states as it comes to high school graduation rates. And again, this constant drumbeat of 100% funded tuition available for low-income, high-performing students, it's just going to be tougher to attract those students to our institution. So what do we do? We'll offer 70% discount, but it's unfunded discount, right? And so we dig ourselves deeper into the hole. Departmental demand shifts post-crisis. Parents have a lot of home equity. Now they're underwater. You need to go to school and you need to get a job, right? So there are pressures that are being experienced by humanities students. My kids are mostly humanities students, and I'm delighted for that. I feel those are the classes I wish I could go back and take, but that is not the reality of the focus on employment for many. There is an accelerating disappointment of alumni that are 5 years out. Think about the measures that we look at. We look at maybe average starting salary, the other things that are required. Think about the auto industry, you know, total life cycle costs or 5-year JD Power surveys. How do we get ourselves more in the mindset of measuring the real value that we're creating out there? Because these are the people that are marketing for you. These are the people on Yelp. These are the people on social media. Trend of separate vocational training. I say separate just because vocational training isn't just trades. There's obviously community colleges that are doing gen eds and then feeding us. But there is also this realization that many of our kings of industry avoided college altogether. Some are actually paying $100,000 grants that you can apply for to not go to school. Because trades such as coding or technology development don't really see the same value in this. So these are trends as well outside of broader demographic trends. And then philanthropy, right? Even if endowment being larger was our funding strategy, who are your 10 biggest givers and how old are they? I see this really acutely in the church. We have 875 churches throughout the U.S., and I don't know what that number would be, but the tenuousness of churches that are maturing age, the nature of philanthropy changing to a generation that really wants to be much more integral, physically involved in the mission and what we're doing. And so we have to be realistic even about the stability of the funding base for our traditional endowment. So, the context today and a few of our responses, which we've largely talked about, were certainly every time I've tried to predict the market, I've been wrong 100% of the time. It's a special gift that I have. So I've stopped telling my wife when I think I have an idea. But we're definitely closer to the end than the beginning of this run. And so think of it, we're sitting here talking about these pressures, which we all feel and can be daunting in the midst of things having been pretty good for endowments and certainly for the cost of borrowing. And so rising rates, student debt, all of these things, the inability for alumni to get rid of student debt in bankruptcy or liquidation, and except in very unique circumstances, is causing institutional pressure and student pressure. I think we are culpable in this. This isn't just something that happened over time. I know for me personally, coming from kind of a corporate set, I tend to have much too short-term of a focus. We all experienced shock after 2008, and we want to know where is enrollment, what is retention this term, what's the endowment return, should we have a new advisor. Everything is too much focused on the short term instead of the white space. So a lot of these metrics, it's hard to find our client in it, retention rate. That's an institutional security, enrollment, institutional security, endowment risk, institutional security, annual fund. Where is it at to fill the gap? How do we spend more of our time actually creating value metrics for those that we serve? Adjunct faculty, we've talked about it. It's pretty obvious why we're doing it. But what is the cost? Or what is the cost of just cutting to the bone, right? Because it's a way, again, to delay some of the funding pressures that we'll have. And so we have to be careful about that. Lastly, a lot of talk, but little movement on a lot of real productivity measures and outcomes. Again, the auto industry has different metrics which would do a better job of looking at an investment over a long period of time. And again, I think back to Blue Ocean, we spend a lot of time talking to each other, and what we realize is it's probably better that the incredible wealth of information that you bring from your own contacts gets more airtime. Even if the ideas are bad, I've had so many bad ideas in my life, but it's fun to imagine, poke a little bit at the model to see how we might restructure things. And so now I'm going to walk you through, with the last period of time, one of those attempts to poke, if you will. So this is a context. It's a very small. This is how we got connected. And this is not a solution. It's not a panacea. It's got all kinds of problems. But it's novel. And so it's an idea. And I think it's an idea that's at least representative of something we need to think about more in larger scale. So the context is, we had a single institutional department focused largely on ministry training in seminary. The executive team has done a lot of incredible hard work to enhance hybrid delivery options, right? So first of all, before we look at the funding model, how do we look at more remote, online, but also intensive in-person mechanisms to attract a larger base, right? We're looking at the model. It's not just funding. In fact, right now it's all structural. The second thing is, let's look at our highest fixed cost, residential core four-year program, and let's turn it into three. So that even if you're not reducing fixed costs, what are you doing? You're increasing the volume you can push through that program. And you're not just doing something structural for the benefit of you. You're shortening the duration. You're creating value for the student, right? These are structural changes which create value. Then we shift to funding. Now that we know we're doing some things that should create value, how do we fund it in a different way so that we have both elements? Back to the cab example, this is not just funding, structural first. So what if we could develop a captive, non-government, private, self-administered 0% loan fund? And what if we could build in incentives that not only cause students to persist and complete, but also to thrive, because we could surround them with coaching that would restrict their ability to get into trouble in other areas. So I remember we were talking about this with the Association of Theological Schools, and one of the objections was, we have institutions that are free, but students are still in trouble because they're borrowing large amounts of debt to live their life. So how do you put negative covenants in as a part of this program to say you're going to have a coach and we're going to help you to stay from trouble? So this was an idea. So how might we accomplish that? So before we started talking about this, consider that the program, the three-year proposed program, if we didn't do anything, was probably going to be about $24,000 net tuition. And so in the traditional economic model, if the institution receives 24, the student pays 24 through various means, private pay, loan, grant, whatever. Right? So institution and the student ultimately are at the same level. That represented something on the order of a 50% discount, largely unfunded. And if we found a student that we would really, really want to have as a part of our community, maybe we'd bump that up to 70, because when you're giving away money you don't have, you can do that. And And we need enrollment because we're 80% fixed cost, right? And so we've seen this trend and this cycle that we get on. So how could we start to think about that? And we've thought about this concept of how might we flip this endowment model or this campaign model to activate it. And so we also looked at, for this program, not a lot of external grants available, not a lot of designated funding, at least to serve a larger number of students that we hope to over time. So not a lot of other opportunities for funding. So institution was suffering because they're giving unfunded discount. Enrollment is lowering because they hadn't yet made any of these structural changes to make it more attractive. And students and alumni who had been through it were suffering because of the total life cycle costs of the interest that was accruing in this longer program, and then the interest rates, which can often be punitive, as you know, into the future. So we had a new vision. We still have a new vision. This is not a finely tuned machine. This is a work in process. So treat it as that. But here's the vision. What if we had a new campaign? And what if I came to you and I said, do you really want your name on another conference room in a science building? Or would you rather transform the lives of the next 1,000 pastors within our denomination? Right? So you switch the narrative from something that, you know, is focused on building something and securing enough endowment so that we can sustain our existing model to, how about you participate with us in giving new life, now that we've done these structural changes, to be a catalyst for these young lives that'll transform the world, right? You can already sense that's, I'm no advancement person, but that's a compelling vision, right? It's different. The next thing we did is, and the way that we're operating this program right now is very small, and it's not in this exact format because we've been trying to pilot it before we go out and talk to our, collective donor base. But the idea is, with that campaign, let's not actually use that money. Let's invest that money in a market portfolio over a long period of time. Not worried about where the market is now. I've gotten that wrong every time. This is what happens, by the way, when you get a banker involved in educational funding. But here's what happens. So we invest that over a long period of time. We actually don't run the program out of that. Instead, we work with an affiliate lender of the church who gives us a line of credit that's twice the size of the money we raised in the campaign, and the campaign is used as collateral. With me so far? So if we raised $1 million, we would have a $2 million line of credit. The $1 million would be invested in a stock and bond portfolio at an appropriate level of risk. And the debt facility at $2 million would begin to fund the loan program. Okay? And it's collateralized by the equity that we would have raised. And it does have interest on that line of credit. The lender requires some return. So now, the loan program is actually administered by a new partnership, a separate organization. And there's lots of reasons for that. But one of the primary reasons is that even though it's a captive loan program, the institution doesn't want to get into a separate, they want to change the way that we market our services. And they want to be able to say, this is a captive program, but it's run by them. So we don't want to burden the institution with having every student say, well, can I have a different version of that program? And so administratively, it creates some simplicity. Okay. So over a long horizon is the only horizon in any scenario where good decisions, real good decisions are made, right? Think about it. You go to another job because it's $2,000 more, not a good decision, generally. Unless there are other compelling reasons. Long term is the right horizon. And over a long period of time, the invested return on the capital should exceed the cost of borrowing materially on the debt facility. And think of it on day one, as we start to fund this program, we're investing $1 million and we have $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 on which we're drawing. So long term, that differential creates margin. What do we do with that margin? three things. We actually use that margin to pay the institution a funded level of tuition that's accretive to what it's receiving today, actually materially accretive to what it's receiving today. So now instead of a 50 or 70% unfunded discount, they're actually getting some payment more than that in funded dollars from this program. Secondly, we build in incentives for the student to complete. They have to come. They have to be approved. They have to do what they said they're going to do. They have to persist at a minimum level. And we're going to surround them with coaching that prevents them from doing other things that could cause them harm in the future. The third thing, which isn't on here, is that as part of this, think about in healthcare, when you go get a healthcare service now, they want you to pay more of your own self-pay when you leave. You have no requirement to do that. You can wait for your explanation of benefits. So if they say you owe us $200 and you say no, they'll say, well, how about 50? Because they're just trying to get more of that self-pay money now and lower their default risk. So what we do as a part of this is students don't owe anything while they're there. No interest accrues. But at the time of graduation, they owe $5,000 as a part of this program. They can get it through prayer partners. They can get it through 50 people at $100. They can get it through any means. And they can raise plenty more than that, and it just comes off their obligation at the end, which you'll see. The third thing that we do is we use that excess to subsidize the interest that we're paying the lender, and we bring the student's interest cost down to zero. So what they owe back at the end, they owe no interest while they're in the program, and when they're out of the program, there's no interest accruing. And so let me show you a little bit of the practical reality of what this means. But the concept in total is that what we've done is we've flipped the concept of the endowment. Rather than endowing us to put it over here, to bleed in at an ever larger rate for an operating model that's under pressure, we've turned it and asked to kind of use the endowment in a unique way to transform the operating model so that we won't need the endowment as much for a rainy day. So hopefully you can see that that differential. And here's the thing. What I'm about to show you, there will be periods of time where the excess that we're earning isn't enough to cover everything we want to do. And so over time, the funds decay. But we've set up a structure where we think we can go 10 to 12 years without any incremental funding into that original donor gift. So think about this. If you get this clicked on, think about your annual fund strategy. Where does it go? It soaks up the hole in your operating budget, right? Unless you're materially different than any other institution. At this point, the annual fund, if we're strengthening the operating model by paying better tuition to the institution, and we can strengthen that in enough scale, the annual fund can go into this collateral pool that allows us to keep building it, to scale it, and serve more people over time. And so we flip the whole concept of even what the annual fund is for. We're transforming the operating model. And I'm talking about this like this is a huge program, and we figured it out, and nothing could be further from the case. I just want to let you know I'm excited about the possibility of it. Yeah. What percentage of your operate? Oh, you mean what percentage would this have to cover to make it meaningful? So I thought about putting in like our model, which you would have been not interested in. It's totally program dependent, right? So we have this model that it depends on the tuition cost, it depends on the discount rate, it depends on the interest rate, it depends on who the lender is and what rate they're charging. Think about this. What if, in the case I just mentioned, we raised a donor campaign and then we had a credit facility which was collateralized by it? What if you had part of your endowment that was already available to put up as collateral, and instead you went to your donor base and you said, usually give us money, 100% of what you give us. How about giving it to us in the form of a zero interest loan? And we'll give it back to you, which is 100% more than you normally get. And then you don't even have to subsidize the cost of the debt in running the program. And then 3 years later, you go back, or 7 years, and you say, Evan, thank you so much for contributing to this. Let me show you the lives we just transformed. Here's your $50,000 back. By the way, why don't you give it back to us and we'll go do it again. And now you're just recirculating capital for free, but we've changed the nature of the model. So the answer is, what we're doing so far isn't material to the operating budget of what we're focused on, but we're playing with it so that if it works, and there are elements where students are saying, I would not have, we know that finances aren't the only reason that people aren't traveling across the country to be in residential programs, which this is trying to incent. We have heard from multiple kids that they would not have looked at this program but for the benefits that it offers. So let me give you a little more data as we close, because this will put some flesh on it. The right side of this is an example of kind of the status quo. We reformed the program, but still, with no funding differential, there'd be a program cost of roughly $24,000 on a net basis to the student. That's also what the institution would effectively be getting. But they would accrue over $4,000 of interest during the duration of the program. So they'd owe $28,300. Then they'd take an interest rate, which at best would be 6%, in light of where the market has gone, which would be a payment of $413 a month for 7 years. And their life cycle costs, assuming no default, assuming everything went smoothly, would be $35,000 for the student, right? Also embedded in there is the institution would receive 24. If you flip to our model, the net tuition is actually higher, and there's some things in here that I didn't put in. But the reality is, because of the earnings that the program generates, we're actually able to pay the institution a funded tuition that's even higher than this. So whereas the institution was receiving this, and the student was paying this in some form, now the institution receives this, the student ends up paying this, and with zero interest. And so there's no interest that accrues during the program. Ideally, the earnings margin created by the program absorbs that. They do owe a crowdfunding amount at graduation. If they do that and they persist in the program and they get discounts in the program for performing at an adequate level academically while they're getting coaching, they owe $21,000 back. And at zero interest over 7 years, it's $250 a month. And we did research with people coming out of the program to say, at what level would you start to say that sounds really feasible based on starting salaries, all of those kinds of things. Now, think about this. It's a crass example, but it's true. If you go to the RV or the boat show, what do you see on the side of the RV? Not the price. You could own this for $280 a month for 18 years at 35%, right? They don't show that. That's the fine print. The other thing that we're flipping is, over time, how about stopping talking about the madness of gross rates or net rates? And let's put it in terms that students can actually understand, except we're not taking advantage of them. We're doing it at zero interest. So if you come and you get accepted and you're part of our community, we'll surround you. There's some patina, hopefully, about being involved in this program. And at the end of the day, no more than $250 a month. Why? Because if your aunt decides this is such a wonderful program of stewardship that if you raise your five, I'll match it, then this comes down to $16,000 a year divided by 84 months, and your payment goes straight down. There's no math to do. That's all the student owes back. Lastly, two more things. One is, it's basically getting this program for the cost of a used Camry. Because if you were to buy a used Camry at $16,000 or $17,000 in an interest-bearing loan, your life cycle cost would be more than this. Lastly, the excitement is that if you could switch on alumni funding for something like this in a scale way, think about the impact on potential default rates to be able to say, our alumni made this possible for you because they love this place, because they care about you. You have an obligation to pay this forward so that others can benefit. Because the other thing we have to cover in this structure is default rate, which will clearly happen. But is there a way to radically change the default rate by the way that we market the program at the same time? Harvard, I don't know, 10 years ago, set up a captive alumni loan fund because Harvard knows that they're going to pay it back, right? How do we create some of those advantages at institutions that have a different structure of alumni base? So it's hard to know how much detail to show. That's not really important. This structure really isn't important. Maybe the only thing that's important is if there's something in it that poked or that provoked a little bit to say that there's more space needed to do this kind of stuff. And not with me talking, but each of you bring expertise from incredible areas that can think about these issues that we have in different ways. And so my admonition is, I love our friends in academia, and we are blessed with incredible leaders and incredible faculty, but sometimes the answers will come by thinking about it in new ways because we don't have the same level of understanding of these issues, and that's a good thing. That's okay. Bring new ideas to it. Give yourself a whole lot more white space to think about it. And I find in my life, when I do, it's also a lot more fun to be a trustee because you're being asked to bring the gifts that you have, whatever those might be, into your service. So I'll leave it there. Appreciate your time today, and happy to take any last questions if you have them. Yeah.
How many years have Covenant been doing this program, number one? And number two, did you implement it for all 4 years immediately with students at whatever level they were in?
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So 2 years, small pilot program. Right now it's denominationally funded. So we didn't, you know, you can understand the institution isn't going to want to go out to its donor base before we prove that it can work. So we put up the capital and said, we're going to, you know, this is interesting enough to us that we want to test it. And no, we started it with the incoming class. So you run the issue of I didn't get that. Here's the other thing, though. So wouldn't it be fun? So you just asked two central questions. And if we had another hour with all of your experience, you would ask every question we asked through this process and probably more. What we realized, though, is back to fixed costs. If this could be enough, because the institution would say, well, what if we have someone we really want and we want to provide a much larger scholarship? Right? How might we do that? We'd be off kilter. Well, if somehow you could use the catalyst of the program redesign and a financing model to be enough of a catalyst to generate enrollment and you cross over your break-even threshold, now the beauty of being a fixed cost model is now everyone you add, your fixed costs don't change and it's all profit. And now you've got real value creation that you can dole out 100% scholarships and you have funding to secure it. And so we are a long way, but it's exciting to be a part of it as a start. And so this isn't something you can flip a switch and apply to your whole institution. But are there areas in your institution where you'd like to attract someone, where you could create a value proposition with a program design? Food for thought. So, yeah, three-year program. Yeah. Well, there's always those that fear any creative structuring idea, rightfully so. Bankers have blown up many things in the past. I would say on the whole, there was some reticence from administration at large just on the donor piece of it, which is totally understandable. I would say the faculty were pretty excited. They were worried about, I call it good anger. So if you limit it to this program because you're trying to drive residential community development and get people to campus who would otherwise not come to campus. Then you have six other programs who go, well, what are we going to do for my program and my program? And so it was excitement about the program. It's how to modify it for five different kinds of tracks that students could take without making it too cumbersome. But if it's a way to incent kids to come into the program to fill up these classes, I would say generally we haven't had a whole lot of pushback. There's been excitement about it. Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yeah.